Okay, so today we want to, I want to discuss Cauchy's theorem. And so there are two versions of Cauchy's theorem. One is by Cauchy, another one is by Cauchy and Goursat, I guess, which is a generalization. So the Cauchy's theorem that I'm going to kind of sketch today is that suppose you have some, oh, I should maybe wait 15 seconds. According to the clock, it's not 9 o'clock. So suppose you have some simply connected region U, and you know it's some open subset of the complex plane. And suppose gamma is some curve, closed loop, enclosing that simply connected region, which is the boundary of that region, in which f of z is holomorphic and f, the first derivative of f of z is continuous. I wrote, what I wrote down in the notes is actually wrong. I said that f prime of z exists, but this actually needs to be continuous. And so I'll correct that in the notes before I, you know, upload it to the wiki. And this is the condition that is relaxed in the Cauchy-Goursat theorem, where you can actually show that if f of z is a holomorphic in some simply connected region, then it follows that that f prime of z is actually continuous. So it's very easy to prove this version of this theorem. We just use Gauss's theorem in two dimensions, which also goes by the name of Green's theorem, I guess. Some people call it Stokes' theorem. So. Do you know the story of Stokes? This may be completely apocryphal. I have not looked into it, but it's a funny story. Stokes had discovered his theorem, but he has not published the result at that point. But he decided to set it as a tripos, exam question in Cambridge. And only one student apparently got the question right. And apparently it was James Clerk Maxwell. This may be completely, apocryphal story, but still, I think it's quite interesting, funny, at least. So we know that Stokes' theorem, says that if we have some two-dimensional vector field, then the line integral of that around some closed loop is given by so let's call this domain D, is given by the surface integral, the two-dimensional curl. Right, this is what we call Stokes' theorem. So more explicitly, we have in component language I think I have my signs are right. And this is very easy to prove. As you may remember. So now if I apply this to this integral, then we just look at the real and imaginary part of this. And we can rewrite if we right? So this is and then we apply Stokes' theorem to each of the to the real and imaginary part of this, and then basically what we get is that our favorite derivative something like this. And this is basically, as you remember, this is nothing but d by dz bar, and this is f of z, right? So because, right. So this is a 2 of, right. And by the Cauchy, because f of z is holomorphic by the Cauchy-Riemann equation, we get this. So this very nice and simple theorem has lots of consequences. And one of the immediate consequences is so suppose that if you deform that the line integral of holomorphic function is independent of the path that you take from the endpoints of the integral, unless you know the path in deforming the path you cross a singularity of the argument, or you pass a point where the function is no longer holomorphic. So what do I mean? Is that suppose you have a point A and you have a point B, and you have some path, say C1, and you have another path, say C2, and in the region in between, the function is holomorphic. Then Cauchy's theorem tells us that C1 plus C2 f of z d of z is 0, which we can now we can decompose this integral as an integral going from A to B along, sorry, I should write like this, say C2. So the path going along this, f of z of d of z, and the path going plus the path going along say this, so minus c1 of f of z d of z. Now, if we now reverse the orientation of this, that will absorb this minus sign. And from there, we see that the integral from A to B is independent whether we took the reverse of the C1 this way or C2, right? And that's because we did not cross a point where FZ, failed to be holomorphic. So all this very nice. Given Cauchy's integral theorem, we can even, Cauchy's integral theorem was proved for regions of the complex plane which was simply connected, but now we can show that you can extend it very easily by using that sort of argument to multiply connected region. So what is a multiply connected region? Roughly speaking, it's a region which has holes in it. So for example, we have some big curve, say C1, and suppose we have a small little, so let me just put the orientation here, like say C2, C3, then the region bounded by C1, C2, and C3. So, you know, this region, that's a multiply connected region. So one of the things about multiply connected region is that you can draw closed loops there, which cannot be shrunk to a point continuously, right? So the way to do this is to show that Cauchy's theorem is valid for multiply connected region is to basically introduce some crosscuts. So these are very thin cuts in this, which make the whole thing into a simply connected region. So we are doing some surgery where by one we are making this region simply connected. So we go in that sense, and then we go in like that, then we go in like that, we come out like this, right? So in this, you know, deformed integral, deformed as in like modified integral, curve, you know, it's obvious that by Cauchy's theorem, that this is zero. But now we can write this as C1 plus, you know, L1 plus C2 plus L2 plus gamma, let's call this, you know. But by making these two paths arbitrarily close to each other, and because fz is a holomorphic function there, you know, we can see that the contribution from L1 will cancel the contribution from L2 in the limit that those two go very close to each other, right? So the contribution in this integral from this crosscut parts, the contributions drop out. So this integral basically becomes an integral over C1 plus, you know, now here you see this is taken in an opposite sense, right? So let's take this circle going in the opposite way. So C2, and then C3 is zero. And then what we do is that we take this to on the right hand side, and so this is C1. And then these guys pick up minus sign, and then we reverse the sense in which the orientation. So thus we see that. So this is a very nice result. So let me fill in the blanks now. So this is so in other words, if you have some simply connected some curve like this, C1, and if there, suppose the function has some singularities, some poles or something there where the function is no longer holomorphic, then the line integral of the function over this bit curve can be decomposed as sum over line integrals around each of these points. Okay, sorry, I'm going fast because I have to cover a little bit of territory before we actually get into what was scheduled to be today's lecture. So another a consequence of Cauchy's integral theorem is that Cauchy's integral formula, which is not going to be proved. But it's not very hard to prove. Sorry. Oh, what am I doing? You see, my second cup of coffee this morning, I didn't have that. I'm trying to cut back on coffee. Because I'm like, by the end of the day, I'm like, oh my God. Okay, did somebody have a question? Or? Oh, good. I like a class that doesn't ask questions. At least not pesky questions, you know. You should only ask questions that I can answer. From now on, I'll email you the questions that I do for you. So Cauchy's integral theorem leads to Cauchy's integral formula, which says that if you have some region, say, where F is holomorphic, so C is some curve bounding some region D, and F is holomorphic, and A is some point in that inside that region, then the value of the function, holomorphic function, at that point A is given by a line integral around the boundary. So which is, so if you know the value of the function over some closed curve, and you know the you know that that function is holomorphic in the region bounded by that curve, you know everything about that function, because Cauchy's integral formula gives you the value of that function inside that region. And this is connected to the fact that if f of z is holomorphic, then all its partial derivatives exist. And therefore, you can actually do a Taylor expansion in the region. And so very nice and beautiful. And also, this is I find it, there's an analogy with electrostatics. And you may remember that Laplace's equation in electrostatics, there was this famous boundary value problem, right? But there's this uniqueness of solution of Laplace's equation. You all proved it in your second, third year undergraduate, that if you, you know, for a given boundary condition, the Laplace's equation is, you know, is unique, you know, in the interior of that region. So this is kind of the two-dimensional version of that. All right, so if you differentiate the Cauchy integral formula under the integral sign, say you differentiate now n times, so now so this is a handy notation, is to write it like this. And because if you're differentiating, you know, here this would be, this would amount to differentiating with respect to A. And because everything inside the integral, of course, apart from this, well, only the, I mean, this factor depends on A, this factor doesn't. So you just get something, you just get this. So I'm now switching to T being the integration variable. Right. And then the Taylor expansion is simply and the Taylor expansion is valid inside this region where it's holomorphic. Okay. Now what's interesting is that And a very another useful series expansion of function is in annular regions, that means it's a not simply connected region, is known as the Laurent series, and that's actually a very useful thing. So I wonder what the carbon footprint of these blackboards is. Suppose you have some annular region. So an annulus is basically something, the region bounded by two concentric circles. And for our purposes, the second circle can have infinite radius. So suppose some function is holomorphic in an annular region where your the radius, the center is z naught. And so z is some point in this annular region. Then there's an expansion of the function in that region given by a series called the Laurent series. So this is but now notice that n now goes from minus infinity to plus infinity. So this and the expression for an is actually exactly the same expression for the Taylor expansion. So if this is some curve C and Z is interior to that, then so this is interesting because what makes the Laurent series different from the Taylor series is that since n can be negative, that means that this expression blows up at z equals z0. And so the Laurent series may or may not have, the series may or may not terminate at some finite value of negative n. It'll depend on the function. But the point is that there is at least, one term in this expansion where n takes negative value. And and those are the points which would be the singularities or the poles of that function. Okay. So this is a very intuitive way of looking at Laurent series, is that you need some negative powers because you need the function to break up, to explode. And so another important thing is that the Laurent series expansion, yes?
Just because it's an annulus, so are we saying the inner circle, the function inside that entire region can be ill-defined or would be ill-defined?
I think there has to be like a finite number of like poles.
Finite number of poles inside.
Yeah, but it cannot be like some.
Entirely missing.
Right, yeah. Okay, what was I gonna say? Damn it, Salt, you broke my train of thought. No, it's fine. Okay, that's why I have this, the script. Right. Oh, yeah. So now suppose if you chose another point here to do the expansion, say z naught prime, because z naught doesn't have then the expansion around z, so for the the expansion, the Le Hong expansion, you know, can be different.
Yeah, but the thing that it's defined on the end is Asinda, it has to do with the fact that
there's a singularity.
The converges in that annulus.
Right, precisely. Right, yeah.
So it might be possible, for example, that your function can be defined, well-defined outside of the annulus, but its Le Hong series won't converge in there, I guess.
Inside the inner
circle. Right, right. The Le Hong series would be different, yes, yes. Or it won't converge, yeah. Yeah, I mean the series representation of a function is different from the function.
So it's the same, for example, with the Taylor
expansion,
right. When you have the geometric series, it converges just for small x. Right?
Right, right.
But the function 1/1 - x can be defined in whole. In the
exactly. Function. Yeah. So which is basically what we said in the first.
Can be defined in.
Sorry.
What was the last?
What he was saying is that the Taylor series, for example. Is, you know, for example, if you take the Lorentzian, like 1/x² or 1 minus, then that's only defined in a circle around the center.
It's, right, its series converges in that
circle. Right, so the series converges in the circle.
Yeah.
But you know, the Lorentzian is defined for all of the real line and all of, you know, complex plane, except the points on the imaginary axis. So the function itself exists everywhere, but apart from those 2 points, but the Taylor series is only valid in a disk around the, and because of the singularities, you know, the Le Hong series expansion of a function will be different depending on which point you're expanding around.
I have another question. The Lorentz series for a function implies, it needs the function to be differentiable. Not at all, right?
Differentiable inside the annulus. Yes.
Yes, it needs. It is. Right.
I mean, the Taylor series is a special case of the Le Hong series where actually you can write AN as the nth derivative.
Right.
But I guess for the Le Hong series, that must not
be
the
case. Oh, I see. Right.
Right. I mean, AN doesn't necessarily has to be the derivative of F, right?
Right.
No, but
in
the Le Hong series, basically, the series will always converge at any point inside the annulus, but outside that circle.
No. So what Andres is saying is that, you know, in the Taylor series, we had the, you know, that thing had the interpretation it was the nth derivative of F.
Yeah.
So the Le Hong series need not have that interpretation. Yeah. The AN is not FN, FN.
Because how would you define a negative interval?
Be the derivatives of the function.
Well, I guess you can derive. I don't know. Some people have. I have gone to string theory talks where the area is a negative quantity. Yeah, the Connor field theory lecture a few years ago, he was giving a string theory talk where he was talking about negative area. And then somebody asked him, what is negative area? And he said, it's less than zero.
But that's how we find the coefficients, and when we're actually computing them for the Lorentz series, we use that formula, don't we?
Yep.
Yeah. So why would you say it's not defined?
No, it's defined. It's defined. The fact is,
it's
not the same as the
as
derivative.
The derivatives.
Right. It's not that. It's not the nth derivative of the function.
Okay.
So, I should really write with more in a compact way, so I won't have to do any erasing. Okay. So examples. So so find the Laurent series expansion of this function around the origin. So this is we basically we have a so around the origin, this is basically what this thing is going to look like. And as you can see, this has a 1 over z factor term, which means, you know, this is a Laurent series. Sorry? Okay. So all of this is all nice and theoretical, but what's really kind of useful for doing integrals is Cauchy's residue theorem. And so remember that when we talked about the fundamental theorem of calculus applied to complex functions, you know, I showed you that the very fundamental, very easy and fundamental result that this integral is 2 pi I if n is minus 1 or 0 otherwise. So this would lead you to think that if you took a function which was singular at some point, which had some pole, and you did an integral around that point, and you were going to use the Laurent series expansion, then what the term that would actually contribute to this integral was the term which where the coefficient was the a minus 1 coefficient, right? The a minus 1 coefficient, because that is the term in the series where the 1 over z minus z naught would be with power 1, power minus 1, sorry. And because of this thing, that is the only term that will contribute to the integral. Yes, Ilya.
Sorry, just going back a little bit, but in that Taylor series expansion for f of a plus z, is there a reason there's no n factorial in the denominator?
Sorry, in the denominator, is that?
Yeah,
you're right.
Okay, just want to double check.
Oh, there should be a numerator, right?
No,
you're fine.
It's in the Taylor series for f of a plus z. But I guess if you if you define the fn.
No, you're right. There should be, yeah. I think, hang on.
And then that agrees with your a n.
Z to the n
should be.
Yeah, there should be a factorial of 1 over n. Yeah, you're right. Because that's just the derivative, so. Yeah, sorry. You see, this is all part of the grand plan. I make this mistake so you can like to test that whether you're awake or not. So, right. And this observation is formalized in Cauchy's integral theorem. Sorry, Cauchy's residue theorem. And which says that suppose we have some function f of z, which is holomorphic in some region bounded by C, except at a finite number of isolated points where it becomes singular. So we have point z1, z2, dot, 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 say zk. So these are the points where our function becomes singular. And suppose we surround these singular points by circles, then as we saw, one of the consequences of Cauchy's integral theorem was that the integral of the function around C can be written as integral around these little circles. And now around each of these circles, we can draw an annular region. And so around each of the circle, we can basically pick a point and do a Lorentz series expansion. And we do that for every one of these things, where A1n means the Lorentz series coefficient for the function around the, you know, which is inside the curve C1. And then now if we integrate, now using that result, the contribution from each of this integral only comes from the term where n is minus 1. So we get a sum over the number of points, 1, 2, k. So this is a sum over the point 1, 2, 3, 4, 2, k. And we get 2 pi I from each factor. And we get a, this is the pth point, minus 1. So this is, so as you can see, you know, this integral is reduced to a sum over the a minus 1 coefficients of each Lorentz expansion. Because they're so important, these coefficients, these coefficients are called the residues. And so, as you all know, that probably have seen this theorem before, so the integral of a holomorphic function around some curve is sum over 2 pi I, the sum over the residue where x, sorry, the residue of that function at z equals to zi, where zi are the singularities of that function. So this kind of brings us to the realization that given a function that we want to integrate over, what we need to understand about that function is where are its singularities and what are the residues there. In some sense, the residues are kind of the charges. But that's me. Yes?
You talked there about isolated points.
Right.
About if my discontinuity is a curve or a line.
Right.
What happens with this theory?
Can the sum turn into an integral?
No, I don't think so.
No? It doesn't work there.
No. Basically. I'm not sure what to do there. But, you know, for example, branch cuts, when you have branch cuts, then you can still use this theorem by choosing your contour very carefully. Emily, did you have a question?
Sorry, I was just going back, but when you did your example with sine z, what did you do to arrive at that final step? Is that, did you do it?
Oh, I did a Taylor expansion of the denominator.
Sorry.
And then I did an expansion of the...
So it's not the Laurent expansion, that's the Taylor expansion.
Yeah,
no,
but what we...
It
is a Laurent expansion.
It's also
in the
Laurent
expansion. Yeah.
So you can obtain both the same... They both look the same.
For which we use the Taylor expansion in the denominator, using the Taylor expansion in the denominator, you arrived at the Laurent expansion.
Okay, I think I see Emily's question. So what we did is that, so, you know, we did the Taylor expansion of the denominator, then we factor out 1 over z.
Oh, you just factored out 1 over z.
Yeah, and then I did
right.
Okay, so there are two kinds of bona fide singularities. There's a third kind, but it's not a bona fide singularity, so I'm going to really discuss that. But it's one, the poles and poles are basically power law singularity. So if you have some function f of z and it has some, you know, Laurent series expansion around some point A, which is of this form, where n is a positive integer. So if this expansion of fz exists, then we said that A, the point A, is a pole of order n. Right. So if the order of the pole is 1, then it's called a simple pole. So. And there are lots of bad jokes about simple poles, you know, Polish people.
that's in the case where the a minus n minus 1 until a minus 1 is 0, right? If not, it has an an nth pole and n minus one pole?
No, so it's the highest power of
all
it
right.
that determines the order of the pole. So it, so this is, for this, for a function to have an nth order pole, that means that a minus n has to be non-zero. If the negative expansion terminates after, say, a minus 1, then that is a simple pole. Okay. And so what we want, so to, so this is, okay, sorry. The other kind of singularity are called essential singularities. Okay, why is it essential? Before that, poles are somehow, if you define a new function, g of z, which is z minus a to the power n, f of z, then g of z no longer has a pole at that point a. So there's another kind of singularity where you can't do that, where you can't really multiply away the singular point, and those singularities are called essential singularities. And an example of an essential singularity is e to the power of 1 over z, where it's a power series in 1 over z. Because it's an infinite power series in 1 over z, you can't multiply with a finite power of z to get away, to make the singularity go away, right? So this is the kind of the pole, the this is called an essential singularity. Okay, so there's lots of technology around how to calculate a minus one given the function. As far, and most of this technology is actually about how to calculate it for poles, multiple poles. As far as the essential singularity is concerned, you know, most of the time you just do an expansion and you just look at this term and you say, ah. So yeah?
So having an essential singularity accounts for having infinitely many negative powers.
Right. Yeah.
So okay. Black holes are essential singularities?
Black holes? What are black holes? In two dimension, well, you know, we're in two dimensions. Black holes are in 3+1 dimensions. However, if you you know, like I think if you go to 2+1 dimensions, where and look at static solutions of Einstein's equation there. So first of all, in 2+1 dimensional general relativity, there is no graviton. So there is no gravitational waves. But you still have black holes, and they're topological in that sense that they're singularities. And there's a famous black hole solution in 2+1 dimension where the cosmological constant is negative. It's called BTZ, black hole. I don't exactly remember, you know, what kind of singularity it is. And it's like, the question is, are you looking at the singularity, say, in the metric, or are you looking at the singularity of the curvature, right? So things like that. And I would think that I'm just thinking, talking through this, right? The thing about general relativity is that you are free to choose your coordinate system. And that does not change whether curvature is singular at some point or not. The curvature is a covariant quantity or invariant. So some singularity may look power law in one coordinate system. In another coordinate system, you can probably choose some coordinates where it's exponential, some blows up. So I don't think there's probably an intrinsic, you know, value to, you can't really say what is remote essential, and, you know, so this is very, very restricted to complex analysis. So, okay. Okay. So the formula for computing the residue for for a function which has a multiple pole is following. I mean, anyone can derive this formula, except that I always make mistakes whenever there's factorials involved. So suppose we have some function f of z, and this has a pole of order n around the point z naught. Then a minus 1 is given by, well, you take the limit at the very end where z goes to z naught. It's 1 over n minus 1 factorial. You basically kill all the terms. Except a minus 1 higher than, whose powers are more negative than this term. But first you multiply it by, and you take the derivative, right? So this is the general formula that you use for finding the residue. You know, but you can see that this, hello. Paparazzi attacks. Or paparazzo, right? That's the singular of paparazzi. Sorry? Yeah, paparazzo is this. This word was introduced by Federico Fellini in La Dolce Vita. Okay. Right. So a lot of times in your calculations, you'll come across functions which are rational functions. So rational functions are ratios of polynomials. So P and Q are, yes, Karen?
Sorry, just going back to this formula, what value of n should we take, or does it work with any?
Oh, yeah, sure. So if the,
okay.
Yeah, exactly. So now, you know, you'll come across, you know, this sort of functions a lot, where P and Q are polynomials. So the singularities of these guys are from the zeros of Q. And then, right. Right. So this will have a simple pole. So suppose z equals to z naught is a zero of q But it's the first derivative of Q doesn't go to zero. It's only under these conditions that Z equals to Z naught would be a it's only under these conditions that the Z equals to Z naught would be a simple pole. If this wasn't true, then it would not be simple pole, because that means that you would have there are two zeros of this polynomial is coinciding at the same point, right? And the expansion would have a higher order pole. And in such case, the residue of this function at that would be just given by Z going to Z naught. So residue of F of Z at Z equals to Z naught is given by limit of this going to right. So okay, so tomorrow in our tutorial we'll get a lot of experience, like a lot of practice with residues. I'm going to do just one example here. There are some examples. Yeah, if you are not sure, please do those examples. It's instructive. You know, find the residues, especially all of them. But in today's tutorial, we are going to probably, I haven't finalized the tutorial yet, but we are probably going to work on conformal maps. Yes, Jason?
Could you maybe just give an outline of how to prove that boxed formula? With
the residue? Sure. Yeah. Okay, so you take this, right? And if you multiply this by z minus z naught, you find that the first term is a constant. Right? But the second term has now z minus z naught factor in the numerator. And the next term has higher order. Right, and the term that we are interested in, a minus 1, has how many factors does it have? It has n minus 1 factors of that. So now when you do the derivative, every time you take the derivative, it kills one of these terms. And this killing machine continues until a minus 1 doesn't have a coefficient. Right, and because you're doing... Every time you do a derivative, you're bringing down factors of n and n minus 1. And to account for that.
We divide n minus 1 factorial.
Sorry?
That's the n minus 1.
Right, the factorial. So. Yeah, exactly. So that takes care of this. And then what you've left here, what you're left with is a minus one term and all the positive terms, positive powers. And then when you take this limit, all the positive powers drop out. Okay, so, yeah?
Question maybe related to the last lecture about branch points and all that stuff. If I have a multivalued function that is holomorphic, it's Laurent series, it's only valid at one of the branches.
Right.
So I shouldn't really worry about if it's multivalued or not if I take the right branch.
If you take the what?
The right branch. I mean, one of the branches.
Right.
Because, for example, that function, one over sine of Z, it's periodic, right?
Right.
So in some sense, it's multivalued?
No.
Not necessarily.
No, it's, periodic and multivalued are not the same thing. So, periodic functions, the inverse of periodic functions tend to be multivalued. Yeah. Okay. So we have, oh God, I have 15 minutes. I don't know what to talk about in the 15 minutes. Okay, let's, we can do some examples. So the most canned example is okay. So what I'm going to do is that I'm just going to do one example, and we can then. And then I'll have 10 minutes left, and we can talk about the tutorial problem from last time. Okay. So this is we can just write this as so the singularities are at A is real. So the singularities of this is at plus minus IA. So the residues. So the residue at Z equals to plus A is given by Z minus IA times where the limit goes to Z to IA, this thing. Plus IA. So you basically get 2IA is the residue, right? And the other one will be minus 1 over 2IA. Okay, so so are people happy if I talk about a little bit about the tutorial? Or?
Yeah, how in general do you know the order of the pole?
So how what?
How do you know just by looking at it, the order of the pole? Is it by the multiplicity of the zero?
Right, yeah. In this case, it's a polynomial. And we know that at z equals to ia, the first derivative of the denominator is not zero. So, this is basically a simple pole. There are some examples where it's not a simple pole. Like if you just, there are some trivial examples. If you just raise this function to some power, those poles become multiple, ordered poles. So, So I guess what was not very clear from the tutorial is that how you actually take, how you choose the branches. And so I guess we had a function which was of this form, right? F of z was, say, the square root of z plus 1. Z minus 1, Z plus I, Z minus I, right? That was one of the functions, right? So that to see where we have a branch point or not, we suspect that these guys have branch point at plus 1, minus 1, plus I, minus I, right? There might be something more complicated. To see where there's a branch point, we expand the function around that point. We do something like this. We take z, and then we say, we're going to look around 1. So we have 1 plus e to the power I theta. So now, this is our point one. Now the thing is that theta doesn't have to take value. We don't have to choose the value of theta to go from 0 to 2 pi. We can break up the zero to the circle into other ways. So here, suppose I say theta takes the value from, so you know, before you know, theta is greater than 0, greater or equal to, and this is 2 pi. So now if you expand this function, you get from this guy, you know, you get some stuff, and from here you get e to the power I theta by 2, right? And if you choose theta to go from 0 to 2 pi, then as you go around, this function becomes double-valued when theta reaches 2 pi. And that implicitly means that you're choosing your branch cut like this. You could have chosen this thing to go from, say, pi to minus pi. So if you did that, then that would amount to choosing your branch cut going this way. Okay? And similarly for the others. So this is a kind of a complicated example, but let me, okay. And then you do the same thing for each of those things. So your choice of parametrization of z around the branch points basically determine where you're putting the branch cuts. Yes, Amity?
What's the relationship between the branch cuts at different branch points?
The branch cuts at different branch points. Yes. So yeah. So. So, okay, so this guy had four singularities, right? Now, you can easily choose some parametrization where the branch cuts all go off to infinity. There is no branch point for this function at infinity, so what is happening is that they're somehow joining up. Yeah. In some sense, you know, you haven't really specified how they're joining up at infinity. You know, maybe they do something, you know. But you could have chosen a specification where this, you know, this was your choice, or you could have chosen those two to join up or those two to join up.
So and in this case, they should all join up.
Well, they should join up pairwise. In this case, and
is it always the case?
So why should they join up pairwise? Can't we just take them like this and this?
Well, if they're going to join up on a finite part of your complex plane, they should join up pairwise.
Yeah. Okay.
But if they join up in the even if you go to infinity, because infinity in this case is not a branch point, they should also join up pairwise at infinity. Because if they joined up as all four at some point at infinity, that point would be probably would. Yeah, but that's not the case. Yes, Nima?
Thank you, Lisa. I was saying if you take them to go to infinity, that's like connecting them, it's almost analogous to connecting the vertical and the horizontal. And at the point where the branch cuts are passing through each other, you're ambiguous.
Right, yeah, exactly. So even in infinity, they have to, they shouldn't, because there's no branch point there.
So if they join pairwise at infinity, then isn't it doesn't it cause multivaluation at infinity? I mean, you're saying they should join up at infinity, so I don't quite get.
They can join up at infinity pairwise as well. You're just avoiding writing them joining up on the finite part of the complex plane.
Okay.
I'm gonna, like, as I said, there's a typo in the solution that I sent you here. I'm gonna correct the typo and upload it on the wiki. That has a more, you know, it's similar to what it's formally done to, you know, to study branch cuts. Okay, before we leave, I want to address another question that Kieran asked in the tutorial. He was saying that, you know, what if we define some new variable omega, then we have f of z as omega, and then this suddenly has a branch point at infinity, right? You know, and omega equals to infinity here, omega equals to infinity surely corresponds to z equals to infinity. So why is there not a branch point on the z plane at infinity? And, you know, what he was trying to contest is that, you know, to look at the branch point, the behavior of a function at infinity, we always make the variable transformation where omega goes to 1 over t, right? Or in this case, z equals to 1 over t. And he was saying, why do we have to do that? Well, the reason why is that what 1 over t does is that it maps every point on the finite part of the complex plane to a single point on other parts of the complex plane. And and if you think of the point at infinity as one point, then it's a one-to-one map. And not only that, it kind of doesn't change the winding number of closed loops. So if you have a closed loop on the z plane, on the t plane, that loop will be, you know, mapped to a larger loop, but it'll still have the same winding. Whereas whenever you're doing a variable transformation where omega is some power of z, then you can see that that winding is not preserved. And the multivaluedness of a function is basically related to the this property of a winding, right? So when you go around on a loop on a z plane, if you do this transformation on the omega plane, it's roughly speaking, omega is z to the power 4, so omega is going around very fast, right? So yes.
But what if I choose the variable omega as 1 over z plus 1 and not the other power? Just
right. I think that would probably be okay, because you're probably shifting, right? Just.
But then I also get a branch point at the infinity.
Sorry, what is you're saying omega is z plus 1?
Like 1 over z plus 1.
Right. If omega. So you're saying instead of taking z to 1 over t, I take t to 1 over z plus 1?
Is that instead of like taking omega as encompassing all four of the factors, you just take the z plus 1 factor and apply the variable transformation to that.
Yeah.
But the thing is, as you go to infinity, there you've got a cubic on top and a 1 over z at the bottom, which brings it back and causes it to blow up at infinity. You don't get it to converge.
But is it still a branch point at infinity? That's the point. You know, right now we're not interested in whether a function is blowing up or not. Right? Yes, Emily?
Isn't this supposed to be uniquely defined? Branch points?
Yeah.
Regardless of what.
Exactly, it is. But the thing is, it's a property of your function, and a lot of these variable transformation, they're not one-to-one, the one that Kieran was thinking about, and that's essentially messes up your branch point. Emily?
I'm talking about how the branch cuts join up in this case of the
right.
Sticking.
So okay, so in this case, you know, our function was f of z is 1 plus omega of this thing, of z, sorry. And if you take t equals to, if you take z equals to 1 over t, then basically, then we have 1 plus 1 over square root of t, this thing. So let's call this g of t. And then we have t to the power of 1 fourth. And
I understand why there's a branch point at infinity. I'm asking about, we've got several different branch counts here. How are they connected to each other?
Right, yeah. So So if you take z to be very large, you see that there's a that the branch point near the origin is a quartic root of type of branch point, right? So if you go around a large circle around the origin, you have to go around four times, right, to come back to the same value. So we suggest that the branch cut should not be from 0 to 1. Because if this was a branch cut from 0 to 1, then you should not have to go around four times. You should go around only once.
Yeah. But I mean, the question is that it seems as though there's only going to, the second branch cut, the one at 1, should only occur on one of the sheets corresponding to the first branch cut. Because you only get reached the multi-value.
Oh, I see. Okay. So, I think I see what you mean. So, basically, to see that, what you should do is that you should write out what the values of your theta is in this region, in this region, in this region, and this region. And there are four different possible values. And those are each of those four possible, you know, combination of values will give you one sheet of your Riemann surface. Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay, we are 1 minute over time. We shall see you at 2 today.